from Bondi Beach to the world. Down 14 correspondents in 7 countries. Wherever in the world you are, we are never far away. This is the world famous Bondi Tunes. Bondi Tunes Australia. In the UK, Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International. I'm delighted to bring you an interview by Jeff Dorsett with Gary Kemp from the band Spandau Ballet, courtesy of Livewire.
And a very good day to each and every one of you. And I've got the PR notes in front of me from Gary Hobson. It says, Jeff, you're going to be talking to the suave, sophisticated, debonair and the better-looking member of the Kemp family. So welcome, Gary Kemp.
Oh, well, he's obviously, you know, he's doing his money's worth. He's getting his money's worth out of me. I'm very proud to be talking to you, Jeff.
Oh, right. Super stuff. Well, look, I was involved in part of the interviews with the documentary with Rusty and Marilyn about the Blitz kids story, and you're on it as well. What a wonderful time that was. I mean, I believe Spandau's first gig was there, 5th of December, 1979.
Right, the blue plaque is still outside the building.
Wow. How did that feel? I mean, looking at it there, I never went to the club myself, Gary, but it looks like an amazing array of people and a fun time.
Yeah, it was fun, but we were very earnest with our fun. You know, we were seriously having fun in a way that was, you know, we wanted to get our band off the ground, and we'd found ourselves amongst a group of people that were really all of the same age, that were really interesting people, that were all determined to somehow create the 80s. In the world of culture, and we were the house band. I mean, it isn't something that was unusual. You know, if you look back through pop music history, it's happened quite a lot. You know, Pink Floyd were at the UFO Club in Tottenham Court Road. They were their sort of house band, as it were, of psychedelia. T-Rex down at Middle Earth Club, they were the beginnings of glam. You know, we were just that wave of the next wave of youth culture, pop culture that was coming through, and we were very fortunate to be part of it, because it helped to springboard us into the charts, if you like.
Yeah, I've got a wonderful book in front of me, written by Richard Evans, called Remembering the 80s, and there's a great statement from you there that said, we were taking dance music like Chic, mixing it with punk and rock and the likes of David Bowie. It was a combination of rock and dance music, fundamental marriage to the sound of the 80s, and that really sort of sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was obviously an influence coming from Germany with sort of Kraftwerk, but then Bowie had already sort of picked up on that in the mid 70s, and he'd already taken electronica to a much deeper into the charts, if you like. So we were kind of interested in all of that, and there was definitely a sense of the 70s were yesterday. We didn't want to be involved with talking to the likes of the Enemy or Melody Maker. We wanted our own magazine, and there came The Face, and that was in color, and then Smash Hits, of course, you know, because we were interested in making pop records at the same time. We didn't want to just be, you know, an art house band. You know, I'd grown up buying singles. That's all I'd ever done, you know. So, well, it's not all. I also bought Pink Floyd and Genesis, but I believed in 7-inch singles, and that's sort of where we wanted to end up, really. Yeah. I think all the bands did, you know, Duran, ABC, you know, Culture Club, Human League.
Yeah. I mean, you had 23 hit singles during that period and 30 million albums. Now, I'm not a songwriter, but I wondered, how did it feel, Gary, the first time you heard one of your written songs on the radio?
Well, it still feels good. I mean, it still feels like, you know, I'm excited about it. You know, when this song that's come out now got first played on the radio a week or so ago, you know, I sat there waiting for it, and I wanted to hear what it sounded like on the radio. That's what you're always really interested in. Is it loud enough? Is it sound like the? Is it as loud as all the other records? You know, But you know, everything is a step at a time in music. You aim for that, and then you're aiming a bit higher, and then you're aiming a bit higher. And I'm never, you know, and then you end up in court together arguing.
So. Oh, dear. Yeah. But and what was it like the very first time you went on Top of the Pops? Because here we are, you know, the biggest TV show around at the time. And how did that feel? Presumably, yeah. To cut a long story short, you know, we're on there. And how did that feel for you and the boys?
No, Top of the Pops was the Holy Grail. You know, my life got changed in 1972 when I saw Bowie doing Starman on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, with his arm around Mick Ronson. Yes, we know.
Yeah. And you know, there were other seminal moments, you know, of great, you know, and it was something we watched every week. You know, my nan watched it.
Yeah.
You know, 16 million people watched Top of the Pops.
Sure.
It was a cultural reference point for everybody, and so to be on it was extraordinary. To get into the top five on our first record was even more exciting. And people forget what singles are like then. You know, nowadays you don't have to sell that many. In those days, it was, you know, you had to appeal to a large swathe of the general public.
True, isn't it funny that you could do 26,000 streams or something, and end up with number one on the chart there. And back in the day, how many sold a million? You know, it was incredible the amount that went on. What's your all-time favourite Spandau song, Gary? I mean, mine is Through the Barricades, but I know there's so many. But what's your personal favourite?
I think if you're talking about singles, and I think as a song, that was probably is probably my favourite song. I think as a track that comes punching out of the radio, I think it's Chart Number One. I just think we managed to get that really right. You know, when we first delved into funk and we had Beggar and Coke playing horns, I think that was what we wanted.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
Gone. She says it must be youth that keeps us feeling strong. I see her in a face that's turned to ice, and when she smiles, she shows the lines of sacrifice. And now I know what they're saying. As our sun begins to fade, and we made our love on wasteland and through the barricades. Father made my history and fought for what he thought would set us somehow. Taught me what to say in school. I learned it off by heart, but now that's torn in two. Now I know what they're saying in the music of the parade. And we made our love on wasteland and through. Drums begin to fade, and we made our love on wasteland.
Yeah, you're also part of Nick Mason's Saucerful of Secrets, and I see that a name crops up there, which is Guy Pratt, which is also on your new album. Guy Pratt was a guest on our show about a year ago. What a great guy he is!
Yeah, Guy. So Guy was I knew Guy in the 80s. He played bass with Icehouse, but he also was a great session player. So he played on Madonna records. He played on Michael Jackson records, Robbie Robertson, and then he joined Pink Floyd as the bass player after Roger left when he was in his 20s. And and this is in the late 80s, and he's played on all the big major Pink Floyd tours. He's played with all David Gilmour solo albums. And we're in this this band with Nick Mason, the drummer from Floyd, called Nick Mason Saucerful of Secrets. We do all the early stuff. And it's been very, very successful for us. And I think it's what gave me the confidence to want to come and do this album, because, you know, I sing in the band. It's much more expressive for me as a guitar player, you know, being embraced by that Pink Floyd fraternity. I think that allowed me to come and make this album.
Yeah. And of course, you do an Apple One podcast with Guy. Is it called Rock on Tours, which has been extremely successful?
It's doing really well. Guy and I, you know, talk to other musicians. We've had David Coverdale. We've had Alice Cooper, John Bon Jovi, some really great musicians on, Boy George, Gary Newman. And it's doing well. Yeah, it's doing well. It's just a musician chatting with two other musicians. And I think they open out a little bit more because we understand their life, as it were. We just had Mike Rutherford from Genesis on this weekend.
Yeah.
And I think it came out of the fact that Guy and I, you know, we're constantly cracking jokes on the tour bus. And in the old days, people would have said, "You two get a room." Now they say, "You two get a podcast." And, and that's what we did.
Yeah. Fascinating with Mike Rutherford. Don't want to go too long in the story, but he and I go back quite a long way. And my car being locked in some kind of lockup with steel gates across it, trying to get out, and going back to his tour bus because he'd invited us there to say, has he got any wire clippers or anything that could break in through the steel gates? So that's the time I always remember Mike Rutherford. Now, on the new album, you've sort of said about inspiration with some of the vocals, because you highlighted three bands: Wings, Supertramp, and 10cc. Now, you're looking at great people there. I mean, I've actually got Denny Sewell of Wings on the show tomorrow night talking about Ram On, because they've redone with 100 musicians the original Paul McCartney and Wings album of Ram. So that will be interesting to have a chat. But 10cc, what a wonderful set of people. The only band I know with four lead singers and four writers.
Yeah, no, incredible. And we had The album's out, you know, when I'm recording, I'm often referencing stuff. And because this album was very much about my past, it was about me trying to join the dots with the people that I, the incarnations, the versions of me that I was and how that represents me now, you know. And I think it was a universal feeling of you know, this is something that everyone, when you get to a certain age, starts to think about. And I was looking at a kind of scrapbook of my musical references, and they were, let's try and make our vocals sound like the ones on this Wings record, or this, or the guitar sound like the what he does here on that 10cc record. I've had an eclectic set of albums all my life, you know, everything from Genesis to ABBA. And I think, you know, I wanted to draw on some of the best of my tastes, as it were, and emulate them to a certain extent, because I was singing about my past here and there.
So In Solo is the album that comes out on the 18th of June. How long did it take to put together, Gary, from start to finish?
Well, I'd already started it. I started the writing process while I was in America with Nick, and I was writing the lyrics first primarily, and then I'd started recording some of the demos at home. We went into lockdown, and I wanted to carry on because then I also had a tour cancelled. So I found myself working remotely with drummers like Roger Taylor from Queen and Ash Sohn, who works with Trevor Horn. Guy Pratt played bass. Richard Jones is on this new single. He's from The Feeling. And we did it all remotely. So, we spoke just on Zoom, and then I'd send them the demos, and they would send me back what they'd done, and we'd have a conversation, and gradually it would end up, you know, being on the record. It was a great way to work. I really enjoyed it. But when the studios opened, I went in and I did string orchestras and played guitar loudly in a studio myself. So it was interesting. I think, you know, as an artist, you roll with the punches. And while all that was going on and things were stopping us from doing things the way we were used to doing it, we were just looking for other ways to achieve what we wanted to achieve.
Gary, what are your plans for the opening and get out there and do what you want to do?
I'm working with Nick Mason again. I'm with the Sourceful, are going on tour for mostly around the world. It's been good talking to you, Jeff.
It is super stuff. And of course, like me being a gooner, you're going to be behind your sofa on a Thursday night waiting for Arsenal to implode, which we hope doesn't happen. But I wish you well, Gary. And we're going to play Ahead of the Game, which is the lead single off the album. Comes out on the 18th of June, does the album In Solo. Gary Kemp, great talking to you, and huge success, and hopefully catch you on the road sometime.
Thanks, Jeff. All the best.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Bye.
So this is Gary Kemp for the brand new album In Solo, and this is Ahead of the Game playing.
I love you, wake with such energy. You know I love you, always first to the draw. As fast as you is something I'll never be.
making sense.
This is Bondi Tunes International, the week that was.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting on FM in Australia and New Zealand. And of course, we welcome our listeners around the world. Europe correspondent Declan Hughes is on the line from Dublin's Fair City in Ireland. And he joins me now. Declan, welcome.
Good to be back, Henry. It's been too long.
It's always been too long, isn't it? Big news in Ireland generally, not just Northern Ireland, but Sinn Féin has secured the largest number of seats in the Northern Ireland Parliament. Can you break this down for me? Because I am kind of out of, you know, contact with what's going on politically in Ireland.
Well, you're familiar with the proportional representation single transferable vote system, because we use that in the Republic for all our elections. In Northern Ireland, it's only used for things like council elections and the Northern Ireland Assembly. When they vote in things like the Westminster election, they use the English first-past-the-post system.
Ah, that's interesting. So the
interesting thing about this election is they use the same voting system that we use in the Republic. So it makes it easier for us in the Republic to understand the way the votes go and the transfers between the parties, which is very significant. Now, where the transfers play into play. Now, let's just have a look at this. I'll take two extreme constituencies for you. If you are, say, a Protestant living in West Belfast, there will be nobody in the MLAs representing your actual political interests. So you might vote for the People Before Profit party because all the other candidates running that will probably get in will be from the nationalist persuasion. And the People Before Profit candidate got in on the 11th count with a combined total of votes of just under 3,300. So he would have been voted in largely by loyalists. Okay?
Yes.
But there were no loyalist candidates who were going to get elected in that constituency. I'll give you another example. East Antrim, which is in and around Larne.
Yes.
On the coast there. That's an area where no nationalist candidate is likely to get elected. So you have the official Unionist Party, the Ulster Unionist Party, as they're known. That candidate was the first guy to get elected. There was two members of the Democratic Unionist Party got seats 2 and 3. And then seats 4 and 5 went to the Alliance Party, which is a moderate party, which has people who are agnostic on the union. In other words, there are people there who are moderate unionists, but the general persuasion of the whole party is if the majority of people in Northern Ireland want to stay in the UK, then that's what we will do. But on the other hand, if at some point in the future the majority of people in Northern Ireland want to join United Ireland, well, that's what we'll do then. That's kind of their view. They're almost agnostic on the union. And they were the big winners in this because their vote increased by 4.47%. But they now find themselves with 17 seats in the Assembly. That's an increase of 9. Now, when you consider there's 90 seats in the unions, in the Northern Ireland Assembly, they got a 10% increase of the entire capacity of seats. They got 9 seats and they previously only had 8. So that's a huge increase in their support in terms of representation in the parliament. And yet they only increased their vote by 4.47%.
It sounds all very complicated to me, Declan. Was it a surprise that Sinn Féin came up with this result, having the largest number of seats?
As I said to you off air, Sinn Féin only increased their vote by 1.1%, and they actually gained no seats. They came back with the same number of seats that they had before. But what happened was there was a 6.73% swing against the Democratic Unionist Party and an increase of 5.07 for the TUV Party. But the TUV Party, despite their increase in percentage, got no extra seats.
So in a sense, it's not what Sinn Féin did, it's what the others didn't do or where they went.
Yes, yes, exactly. Now, this was affected in transfers, and this is why it was important to explain to you that the PRSTV system is important in this, because the literally increase of the Sinn Féin vote was only 1.1%. But what was happening was SDLP candidates were reporting on the canvas that they were being told that their transfers that previously went to the SDLP were going to go to Sinn Féin, because there was a move to get a Sinn Féin person in the first minister position, and they had to be the biggest party in Stormont to achieve that. Now, as it turned out, they entered the election with 27 seats and came out of the election with 27 seats. But because the DUP lost 3 seats, that left Sinn Féin as the biggest party in the Stormont Assembly. And the Ulster Unionist Party lost a seat as well. So basically, unionism lost 4 seats.
Yes. I sort of, now I'm beginning to understand this. Declan, I just want to play a quick audio grab of Sinn Féin's Michelle O'Neill, who said the win ushers in a new era. What else is a politician going to say? But that's what she said. Take a listen.
Today represents a very significant moment of change. It's a defining moment for our politics and for our people. Today ushers in a new era, which I believe presents us all with an opportunity to reimagine relationships in this society on the basis of fairness, on the basis of equality, and on the basis of social justice. Irrespective of religious, political, or social backgrounds, my commitment is to make politics work.
Well, I'm very pleased to report that there is a very healthy conversation already underway, and I have always said throughout the election campaign that regardless of the outcome of the election, that conversation was going to continue. Those of us that are for unification will make that case. I encourage those that actually don't have that perspective at this moment in time to also enter into the conversation. Let's have a healthy debate about what our future looks like, something that's better for each and every one of us.
Right. Now, you mentioned when we were talking that you got some more stats on things. I didn't get the details of this.
Yeah, okay. Well, basically, just what Michelle O'Neill and Sinn Féin believe is that if they become first minister, that a border poll, as they put it, is going to have to come on the agenda. And that's basically deciding whether or not Northern Ireland remains inside the UK or not. Now, I get updates from one of the unionist newspapers in the north called the Belfast Telegraph on a regular basis. And I remembered, and I did some research ahead of time on behalf of Bondi Tunes, I hasten to add, just to find out what the results of the last opinion poll on the union in Northern Ireland were. And it was as recent as June 2021, where researchers from the University of Ulster at Jordanstown, which is just outside Belfast, and Queen's University Belfast, polled 1,292 adults over the age of 18. And 53% of those said they wanted to remain in the UK. They were definitely pro-union. And 30% were in favour of a united Ireland. And the rest were a category of don't knows or an independent Northern Ireland or other options that were on the agenda. Now, there's always a belief that Catholics are automatically pro-united Ireland and Protestants are automatically pro-UK. Not necessarily the truth. 17% of people who identify themselves as Roman Catholic said they wanted to stay in the UK. And there was a small percentage, although they didn't give us the figure, there was a small percentage of people who identified themselves as Protestants who were in favour of United Ireland. Now, for people who had no religion, this is very interesting, for people who said they had no religion, 48% were in favour of staying in the United Kingdom and 32% were in favour of a United Ireland. Now, there was another poll carried out in April of 2021 by an organisation called Lucid Talk, and 49% of them wanted to stay in the UK, 43% were in favour of United Ireland, and the rest were don't knows. And The survey also quoted an opinion poll that a northern newspaper carried out in the Republic, where 51% were in favour of United Ireland and 27% in the Republic were opposed to United Ireland.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to ask you about Brexit because obviously it plays into all this. And also I want to ask you about the, you know, will Ireland become, you know, will the Republic suddenly take in those counties, those six counties in Northern Ireland? Is that actually a feasible thing and will it be done? But first of all, Brexit, this plays into Brexit and vice versa. How can, you know, this win for Sinn Féin, if you can call it a win, the fact that they're, you know, basically the biggest party now, how does that affect Brexit in detail?
Well, at the moment, I did my calculations. At the moment, when you throw in Sinn Féin, the Alliance Party, and the SDLP, all of whom were in favour of remaining in the European Union, there are 52 out of 90 members of the local assembly in Stormont in favour of Northern Ireland being in the European Union.
That's the majority, of course.
Yeah, a vast majority. Now, during the Brexit referendum, 56% of the people of Northern Ireland wanted to remain in the EU and only 44% wanted to leave. Now, that's interesting because, as you can see, that is reflected totally in the Stormont poll that we've just quoted.
Yes.
52 out of 90 wanted us are from pro EU parties. Now, that was the reason why they brought in the Northern Ireland Protocol, so that Northern Ireland could stay in the single market and still be in the UK.
And is that actually happening? Is that like,
yeah,
that's effective?
That's actually happening at the moment. Now, there's people giving out about the paperwork involved, and unionists have a philosophical objection to the border being, as they say it, in the Irish Sea, as opposed to being on the land. But nobody wants a return of a hard border on the island of Ireland. So this was kind of achieved as a compromise. So basically, goods coming onto the island of Ireland from Britain are subject to border controls at Larne.
Right, so goods and going into the six counties into Northern Ireland.
Yeah, there was subject to border control alarm because there's a possibility that some of them may end up in the Republic.
Okay. Yeah, you see, that gets tricky, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So that's why, and unionists have a philosophical opposition to that because they're saying that that moves the border into the Irish Sea and that reduces their link with Britain.
Hmm.
But the fact is, as I said, 52 out of 90 people disagree with that and are quite happy. There was a businessman from the north identified on a program, and he said his business has never been better. And he said he would be, you know, from a unionist community. That trade between Northern Ireland and the Republic has never been better. Northern Ireland's exports to the Republic of Ireland have increased greatly since this protocol came in.
And everyone gains, really, don't they?
Everybody is gaining. And yet you have these people. I mean, one of the classic examples was the former leader of the Democratic Unionist Party, Arlene Foster, is from a predominantly agricultural area, the constituency of Fermanagh, South Tyrone. And she was opposed to Northern Ireland being in the EU. She wanted to leave it, despite the fact that all her constituents were benefiting from being able to export to the single market.
Where do you think this is going? I mean, it sounds like kind of unpredictable. And, you know, what timescape are we talking about before this all settles down and, you know, we have a more firm idea of the future?
Well, one of the problems is they're going into negotiations this week about trying to set up another regime in Northern Ireland, a cross-party government. And the DUP are saying they won't go back into Stormont to form a government with Sinn Féin until the protocol issue is addressed. Now, as I explained to you, the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland don't have a problem with the protocol. A small minority do. And it's basically, it's Turkey's voting for Christmas by being opposed to the protocol, because businesses north of the border are benefiting from having access to the single market.
But because
Northern Ireland is seen as being half in the EU and half out of the EU, the unionists are saying, oh, that weakens our link with Britain.
When I was back in Ireland in the 80s as a newsreader on Nova and other stations, we did refer to Sinn Féin as the political wing of the IRA, and it was touted a lot in media.
Yeah.
I've been speaking to some people online who, you know, someone in particular who is very pro the whole Sinn Féin success in the six counties of the north of Ireland. I said that I think that that's probably a thing of the past, being a political wing of the IRA, and that they distanced themselves from the IRA. Is that true to say?
Well, one would say only to a degree, because although the IRA decommissioned their weapons, the Army Council still exists. And wherever Michelle O'Neill goes in Northern Ireland, she's shadowed by a gentleman called Gerry Kelly. And Gerry Kelly is the last of the old generation. Gerry Kelly would have been in Longkesh with the other fellows, you know, the likes of Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams. And he was definitely a member of the IRA. And he's an elected member of the MLA in Stormont. And he seems to be going everywhere Michelle O'Neill goes, as if he's kind of her minder.
Isn't that interesting?
So the phrase that Gerry Adams used a few years ago, they haven't gone away, you know, is still a little bit relevant. Most of the people that are elected are from the younger generation, to be fair. Most of the people, and there's a lot of women in there who never had the whiff of sulfur at all and wouldn't recognize an Armalite from 50 feet. But nevertheless, some of the old guard still seem to be, at the very least, pulling some strings.
Excuse me, where is Gerry Adams?
Gerry Adams has retired from politics.
Right, so he's just out of this. He's just out of there, because he was such a prominent figure.
Well, he writes books, and occasionally gets asked about how his role in the peace process. That's kind of where he is now.
Do you think
people are making documentaries about the Good Friday Agreement and his role in it? And he frequently shows up and he rocks up and he gives them his view on how the negotiations went and their perspective and the whole thing. And he's become a bit of an elder statesman in the same way that Bertie Ahern is. You rolled out for the same kind of purpose.
Yeah, I just wonder, when he looks at this, does he think that he'd like to still be involved?
I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
I mean, he's a quite a prolific author, so if he does have a view on things, no doubt he'll put it in print at some point.
And he will be read and listened to, I would proffer. Right, and I'm thinking that, you know, I was actually talking with our mutual colleague and our Irish correspondent also in Dublin for Bondi Tunes International, Bob McKenzie. I talked to him on our airwaves last week. And I was most intrigued by what seems to be the evident appeal Sinn Féin has on younger people. And we just discussed the fact that young people, you know, they weren't alive during the Troubles in the 70s and 80s up to even the 90s. Do you think Sinn Féin were targeting young people?
I think they are, to an extent, because they have no public memory. But also, a lot of the candidates that are running weren't really aware of the Troubles, because they were probably kids in the 90s and may have, you know, hit their teen years in the noughties. So you look at people in their 30s and 40s now who have no real memory of the Troubles either, who are actually running for Sinn Féin, for local councils north of the border, running for MLA, and will be running for Dáil elections in the Republic whenever they're held.
Yeah, and I'm interested to know, I mean, obviously they learned about this stuff in school.
Well, one would think they learned something. One would think they learned something, yeah.
And the other thing, I think I've been advised that that Sinn Féin is made of many females.
Yes.
Is that a poignant thing?
Well, all I can tell you is that they run a lot of female candidates. They ran an MEP candidate, Lynn Boylan, who did very well and got the Dublin seat at the European elections several years ago. And she served a term as a European MEP for Dublin. And a lot of candidates like her at various different levels. But I will give you one example. There was a candidate in my former constituency. I don't live there anymore. And she got two quotas at the last election. Mm. Now, usually a TD who doesn't run clinics and doesn't make speeches in the Dáil very often, usually in the normal run of the mill in Irish politics, would lose their seat pretty quickly. This lady is probably the laziest TD in the Dáil, and yet got two quotas. And she wouldn't have got two quotas if she wasn't running for Sinn Féin.
Yeah, I'm just interested at the angle that they've gone with this, and it ties in with the younger voter as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so. As I said, like, you know, anybody who remembers bombs going off in Belfast and the like isn't likely to vote for Sinn Féin unless they were in favour of that sort of thing.
Now, if we step aside from, you know, Brexit and a potential reunited Ireland, what policies does Sinn Féin have?
Well, I mean, they're very good at opposing most things that the government do in the Republic, for example.
For the sake of it? Like, for the sake of it?
Well, I mean, you know, at times it seems like that. And at other times it seems like they seem to be slightly left-wing on certain things. You know, they're in favour of more state intervention and this, that and the other, and more state support for this, that and the other. And they kind of talk loosely about a wealth tax as how they're going to pay for it. Now, I'm all in favour of taxing the rich. In fact, I think any earnings you earn over, you know, say 600 million should be taxed at 97%.
Yeah,
because nobody needs more than 600 million a year, to be honest. You know,
it's very Nordic of you. It's very Swedish. Yeah, I agree.
But I mean, you like, know? You would earn your first 500 million at a reasonable tax rate, and after that, you can you know, go take a run and jump. You don't need that much money.
Look, I'm a bit of a Marxist. I can go with that. Just with regard to Ireland becoming, you know, Ireland without it being a republic, well, it'll always be a republic, but within, you know, an inclusion of the six counties in Northern Ireland. What do people in the Republic think of that? Especially, again, I just want to keep going back to young people because they are the future. Is there a sense of interest amongst people, or do a lot of people sort of think, well, does it really matter?
Well, a lot of people are worried how we're going to pay for it. That's the big thing, because the Northern Ireland traditionally used to cost the British taxpayer about 11 to 12 billion sterling a year.
Yeah.
And basically, the big question is, how are we going to afford it? Now, one of the big problems facing Northern Ireland as a society, and this is bad news, whatever your political persuasion, I don't care whether you're unionist, whether you're nationalist, or whether you vote Alliance or whatever. This is a sociological serious issue. There is a thing called the unionist brain drain. And I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, Henry, but it's a serious problem. If you want a united Ireland, the unionist brain drain is going to be a problem for you. If you don't want united Ireland and you want Britain to still be in charge of Northern Ireland, this is still a problem for you. What I mean by that is the young Protestant intelligentsia are applying to go to university, and they're going to university in places like Cardiff, Glasgow, Middlesbrough, London, and even some of them are coming down to Dublin. And when they graduate, they are not going back home. They are choosing to settle in either the Republic of Ireland or Wales or Scotland or England or further afield. And what you're left with is you're left with an aging, ignorant population north of the border.
Yes, as you say, brain drain.
Bad news. Yeah. That is bad news for Northern Ireland as a society, regardless of whether you want a united Ireland or you want Northern Ireland to remain there, because you are losing high-caliber people that you need to run the joint one way or the other.
And it's not a new
thing.
And
I would argue that a united Ireland would be poorer without this young Protestant intelligentsia available to help run the whole country.
Yeah. And of course, this is not new. The old brain drain has been going on for, God, decades out of Ireland, people going to the UK or even Australia.
Yes, Henry, the difference is that when the Northern Ireland nationalists who go south for their education, they all return home.
Yes.
And this is skewing the population in favour of United Ireland.
Yes, it is. It is fascinating.
And
integral to the future of Ireland. You know, as I said, you know, even I left the country and, you know, it was a thing. And, you know, in recent years,
but Henry, you're an example of what was going on in the 80s. Even people with jobs were leaving the country.
Well, yes, I did have a job, actually. So I guess I wasn't a sort of a typical case of someone, you know, getting your bags and going off to London. Okay, Declan, we've got to leave this here. You mentioned a song off air to me, and I'm wondering if you could present this to go out of our interview. And before you do that, I'd like to say thank you, Declan Hughes in Dublin.
You're very welcome. The song I have in mind is an unusual one, but it reflects the point of view that we articulated in the middle of the interview. I'm going to propose that you play Groucho Marx, I'm Against It.
I'd like to submit to you. I think you know what the trustees can do with their suggestions. I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it. I'm opposed to it. On general principles, I'm opposed to it.
He's opposed to it. In fact, indeed, that he's opposed to it.
For months before my son was born, I used to yell from night till morn, whatever it is, I'm against it. And I've kept yelling since I first commenced it. I'm against it.
Knowing Dad as I do, I'd not advise you to displease him or tease him. No, no, don't double-cross him or toss him around. When dear old Dad once gets mad, he's a hound.
My son is right, I'm quick to fight, I'm from a fighting clan. When I'm abused or badly used, I always get my man. No matter if he's in Peru, Paducah, or Japan, I go ahead alive or dead, I always get my man. I soon dispose of all of those who put me on the pan. Like Shakespeare said to Nathan Hale, I always get my man. I always get my man.
Bombgalico.
It's Pop Go the Classics, or How to Get a Good Tune Without Paying Royalties. 1978, and a song featuring a Scottish singer, William MacPhail. William who, you cry? William MacPhail, better known as Scott Fitzgerald, who teamed up with Yvonne Keeley with If I Had Words. Well, he may have had words, but Camille Saint-Saëns had the melody, from the final movement of his Symphony No. 3 in C minor. In addition to Scott and Yvonne, the record featured the St. Thomas More School Choir, and it reached number 3 in the UK singles chart in 1978 and sold more than 1 million copies. Here's one of them.
Yeah.
It's Pop Go the Classics, or How to Get a Good Tune Without Paying Royalties.
Now, 1976, and singer-songwriter Eric Carmen raided the Rachmaninoff archives for two songs, All By Myself and Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. Now, the former, being a slow ballad, was fine, but he gave the latter an up-tempo, which I think really didn't do justice to the source material. So, let's have a quick look at that one. Beautiful theme from Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2. Not done any favors, I believe, by what Carmen did with it. Here's an excerpt, not from Carmen himself, although he did record it, but just to get a female vocalist in for a change, from Northern Ireland's Rosemary Brown, a.k.a. Dana.
Never gonna fall in love again. I don't wanna start with someone new, 'cause I couldn't bear to see it.
And so to All By Myself. That came from Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto. And here's Eric Carmen himself, all by himself, getting a number two spot in the Billboard Hot Singles chart in 1976.
Oh,
From Australia, this is Bondi Tunes. Henry O'Donovan.